Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this episode of Mill Liberty. I am your host, Caleb Franz. This is the voice of liberty for a new generation. I am thrilled to have you here today on this edition of the program. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for joining us. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to us on iTunes. That way we can get our numbers up. That way we can spread the message of liberty together. If you haven't listened yet, we just kind of wrapped up a little bit shorter than last year, but we just kind of wrapped up our Horrors of Collectivism series for the month of October. And of course, it is not limited to Halloween. That's just kind of the themes that we were kind of trying to play on of horror and dread, because the real life horrors and the real life monsters, that is all throughout history. The real life examples of monsters throughout history are much more horrifying than anything that you can find in a horror novel or a movie. So please go back and listen to that if you can. And then today we are going to be doing one last episode on our Liberty Candidate series ever since April. Now, initially I wanted to do this just through the primaries. But then the more I went along with it, well, really two things happened. One, some people were a little bit more difficult to pin down until after their primaries. And then two, I started realizing that that it needed to be along the lines of all the way up to the general election, which of course is on Tuesday. So this will be our last episode of our Liberty Candidate series. This will not be the last episode that we will have Liberty candidates, but this will be your last chance if you are from the area that I am bringing this candidate on from. This will be the last chance to hear from them before, on my program, before the election. Since I live in Ohio, since Election Day is going to be a big day here in Ohio, as it is, I'm sure, for you across the country, but I've brought people on from West Virginia, from North Carolina, New York, you know, a bunch of different areas. But I haven't had one from Ohio, and it is my home state. And I am very happy and very pleased to bring on somebody who's not only running here in Ohio, but is running, in this case, for lieutenant governor. But I kind of, the way the interview flows, I'm asking about the ticket, not necessarily the singular person. And that is for the Libertarian candidates for governor here in Ohio, because I have already voted. I did not vote for either of the two major parties, and I think, you know, I've been fairly open about my struggles with the Libertarian Party. In fact, I did a whole episode on it just a couple of weeks ago on how, yes, I have been struggling with the Libertarian Party in the past, and I certainly have not been enthused about voting for any of their candidates in the past, but this year is a little bit different. This year I have been very excited, and I had mentioned in my episode about Libertarian candidates in the Libertarian Party that I would be voting for Travis Irvine here in Ohio on Election Day, or I got an absentee ballot, but whenever I could get my ballot. And that's exactly what I did. But if you haven't voted yet, I do want you to listen and consider, especially if you live here in Ohio. I know that we have a very broad audience. I try to accommodate as many of our listeners as possible for where they live. So I try to get some of the areas as broadly as possible. But here in Ohio, I believe Travis Irvine and his running mate, who I'm about to interview here on this program, his running mate, Todd Grayson, is a really great ticket. I think that they both really understand the issues. They both really understand why liberty is the priority. And as a little side benefit, if you live in Ohio, or even if you don't, but you don't know this, the Libertarian Party really all third parties, not just the Libertarian Party. But they kind of got shafted in 2014 when the Republican Party rewrote the rules so that libertarians have this huge, I say libertarians just because they're the biggest third party and have the most opportunity and chance at overthrowing some of the Republican seats or Democrats, but more likely Republicans here in Ohio. They were really just completely shafted in 2014. Even if you don't like the candidates necessarily, which if you listen to this interview, I find Todd incredibly likable, and Travis, I have not met Travis and I can't vouch for him personally, but everything I've seen from him, he's incredibly likable as well. But even if you don't like either of these candidates, I do believe that there is something to be said about breaking down the two-party duopoly, especially whenever they are rewriting the rules every chance they get to block out libertarians and third parties, because that's how they really stay in power. If you want to know why everyone looks at libertarians as unelectable, it's because the Republicans and the Democrats write the rules so that they cannot be elected. So it's virtually impossible for them to campaign. So in my opinion, now I would never vote for someone just for that, but it is added benefit. If they mark off all the boxes, that's why I couldn't vote for Gary Johnson in 2016 for president, because he didn't really, at least his ticket didn't really mark off all the boxes. But in this situation, especially since this isn't president, this is governor, so you should look at each race accordingly. They're not all the same. But in this election, I do believe that both candidates are viable. I do believe both candidates are credible. And because of that, I will be voting for them. And you should consider voting for them if you live here in Ohio, not just because they're good candidates. Don't look at it as you're throwing your vote away at them. Look at it as you are giving the Libertarian Party a viable shot at winning elections in the future the more votes they get in this election. That's incredibly important. That's incredibly important for our dialogue. That's incredibly important for Republicans and for Democrats, because it will make Republicans start to act like small government constitutionalists. It will make Democrats act like pro-civil liberty Democrats. That is very important, and it's good for the health of our dialogue and our country and our national discourse across the nation. But, of course, I don't want to tell you how to vote. I am just merely suggesting and providing you the opportunity to hear these candidates that I believe I can give my vote of confidence that you should be able to listen to these. There's a reason why I don't bring just any yahoo on that wants to come on the program to get their name out, because that's not what this series is for. It is for me to hear from people that I think are pro-liberty enough that are worth your consideration. That is the whole basis of this program. And I think we've had a very good run with our Liberty Candidate series. Like I said, this will not be the last time that we have Liberty candidates on, both Republicans and Libertarian Party. And, you know, maybe even some Democratic Liberty candidates. I don't know of any. I don't know where they exist. But if they do, please reach out to me, because I would love, absolutely love, to bring you onto this program and introduce my audience to you. So with that very long-winded explanation, please sit back and enjoy my interview with Todd Grayson, the Lieutenant Governor candidate for the Libertarian Party for governor of the state of Ohio. All right, Todd, welcome to Mill Liberty. I am thrilled to have you here on the program. Welcome.
Thank you. So this is going to be our last interview that I can get in before the election from somebody who is a candidate, somebody who is running, who I believe is liberty oriented. I've had several people on the program this past year, especially since around March or April. Some are liberty Republicans, some are libertarians like yourself, Big L Libertarian Party. And yours is one that I'm rather excited about because it is one that I can actually an election that I can actually vote in. So I want you to go ahead and first of all explain a little bit about yourself, your running mate, and then why you all are running on the Libertarian ticket.
Well, thanks a lot, Caleb. I am a father of five, and we're a blended family. So 2 plus 2 plus 1 equals 5. And my wife and I are very happy to have a wonderful home and a loving family that we're raising. And I work at a small manufacturing company near Findlay, part owner of this business. And we've been around since 1949. So I'm part of the stereotypical, often sought blue collar manufacturing jobs in the Midwest. You know, that's what I represent every day, and it's cool because being in management and ownership, as well as working hand in hand, you know, we're no ivory tower here. We get out right in the factory and talk to the guys and girls that work with us, and so we get a feel for what they're going through, what their challenges are, what you know, what the taxes mean to them, what regulation means to them and to their families. And you know, at a state level, schools are a big thing. You know, what does the school system mean to them? So I think, and you know, tying to yes, Travis too. It's like I've known Travis for about 10 years, and you know, he's been a guy that I see and I've always looked up to as somebody who's willing to I don't want to say put his finger in the socket, but he's willing to say what he means. He's honest, he's straightforward. And that's kind of how I am too. And so tying this all together, I think what you get are two guys who understand the rule of law, who believe in the Constitution of both the United States and the state of Ohio, who have their feet grounded in reality, who don't live in ivory towers, who don't have decades-long political careers and all of the inherent loyalties and you know, required paybacks that go with that kind of entrenchment in the political machine. And so you're getting people who represent you, who are like you, or frankly, who are your neighbors. We don't have drivers, we don't have lobbyists, and we don't have friends in high places.
So why the Libertarian Party, and why not go through one of the two main parties? What was the decision there?
I think fundamentally, for me, and it's funny when you're in the Libertarian Party, a lot of us talk about we came from somewhere else. And it's ironic because we're born free, we're born libertarian. A parent or a coworker or a teacher or somebody convinces us that we're not libertarian, we're actually Republican or Democrat. And then hopefully at some point we realize, wait, I am actually libertarian and I come back home. And so that the funny part is when you come back home, everybody kind of has that, well, when I left, here was the breaking point. And for me, it was voting for John McCain. It was the last time I would say, like, okay, this guy is just a good human being, but he's not the best. I'm not voting for him. I'm voting against somebody else. And I'm not going to vote against the other guy or girl anymore. I want to vote for someone. And then it became pretty obvious to me. It's like, I'm a libertarian. I know fundamentally I'm a libertarian. I'm going to stop pretending I'm not just because it's more convenient politically to be something different. And to me, it's just an honesty point. I'm being honest with myself, and I'm going to put myself through the slog and the trials and tribulations. And why should other people do that was your question. And it's because, quite honestly, either you believe you can fix one of the two old parties or you can't. And I look at it from a market perspective. You know, I'm an amateur economist. I have a marketing degree by trade from Ohio State, but I'm an amateur economist. And one of the things I've learned in economics is a duopoly is almost as bad or can be even worse than a monopoly. And we all inherently understand the monopoly in this case, like politically, it'd be a dictatorship, that that's horrible. And we understand dictatorships are terrible. But we think that because we have two parties, oh, that's competition. That is not competition. It's actually two bureaucracies who get along quite well in the backdoor rooms. They do a lot of the same things. They end up the same thing. They want the power. And they're willing to negotiate and give each other little pieces so that they can keep their piece. And so they'll throw each other districts. They'll gerrymander people out. They'll agree that we'll get rid of this guy if you protect this girl. It's really one big incestuous government party. And so we do have a monopoly. And I'm just choosing to try to break monopoly.
So there's a lot of things that we can sort of branch off from this point, and a lot of things I do intend on getting to. But first of all, I do want to touch on this. How has the campaign been, especially since, if you know, for those of you listening who aren't from Ohio, it's not exactly a fair fight for libertarians, and you can go ahead and get into that a little bit, but how has it been campaigning for you all?
Travis has been working the road hard. We have a lot of volunteers. It's actually been our biggest campaign to date, in that just in terms of the personal commitment, you know, the number of people on the campaign. We have dozens of people working on it. We're dedicated, and we've raised money, and not a lot, but it's enough to kind of keep us going. We've done some radio ads. Travis done a lot of speeches. I'm kind of I'm the vice president of Ohio, and the vice president of the United States doesn't show up for much and doesn't get on many interviews and doesn't do a lot of ads. And so I've done a few speeches in Northwest Ohio, and that's been kind of my thing. I've been supporting a lot in the background, doing little stuff in the background, but visibly, not as much. Because I have a real job, you know, and so does Travis. And that's kind of the rub, is our candidate, our competition is spending eight figures on this, you know, when we're barely spending five. So it's like, it's just, they're shooting bazookas financially. And, you know, we've got a little pea shooter, a slingshot, you know, and you do the best you can. But no, it's not a fair fight. Not a fair fight at all. And they even stack it against us even further, is that they make us spend what little money we do have every few years trying to go to court so that we can actually have the right to say, I'm a libertarian. And I'll take one brief second to make my First Amendment pitch. It seems to almost everyone that I talk to outside the political spectrum, just on a human basis, hey, if I get signatures on a petition to run for office, should I be allowed to say what party I'm running for? And unanimously, people would look at me across it like, well, duh, yeah, like, why wouldn't you? And Ohio law prohibits you from doing that unless you're a Republican or Democrat, or your party got at least 3% of the presidential or gubernatorial election the previous cycle. So every 2 years, you have a shot at getting 3%. And if you don't get that 3%, you can't say what party you're from. You have to be independent. And I make the easy connection, you know, I'm from Perrysburg, Northwest Ohio, and we have a water issue in Lake Erie. And if I wanted to have a water party, you know, a party dedicated to cleaning up Lake Erie and cleaning up the intakes and having better water and less runoff and whatever it is, right? I'm not legally allowed to do that in Ohio unless I run a presidential candidate for the water party of Northwest Ohio, which clearly makes no sense.
Right.
Or if I run even a gubernatorial candidate for the Water Party of Northwest Ohio, which makes almost as much little sense, you know, almost a little sense. And so we're blackballed. And that's why Travis and I we're realistic. Obviously, we're not going to beat DeWine and Cordray, or as I call them, DeCordray, because they're the same guy. But what we want people to realize is that it is one big party. It's one big government incestuous party. And that if you want to ultimately fix government, you want to fix bureaucracy, and you want to fix what it is to be a citizen underneath government these days, you have to just be willing to, and I'll say it in a tongue-in-cheek way, throw your vote away, but rather throw your vote at something that matters. We matter. Our voice matters. And the more you put your finger in the eye of the two old parties by saying, I was willing to vote Libertarian. I was willing to buy your message of throw a vote away. I said, fine, you know what? I will throw it away. I'm going to throw it away at somebody who cares about me and my feelings and my opinions rather than two guys throwing mud at each other at $50 million apiece.
And that actually leads to a really great segue. You know, what exactly, because obviously, like you said, I don't think that either of you are blind to the fact that this is Mount Everest essentially for you. You know, you're not, it's to the truest, fullest extent, this is David versus Goliath. So with that being said, is it, you know, getting people to vote more Libertarian? Is it maybe trying to place something that's not third? Is it trying to break up the duopoly of the two parties in a meaningful sense, so that way in the future Libertarians can have a really viable shot? What's the biggest thing that you want to walk away with in this election cycle? Aside from, obviously, it'd be great to win, but obviously that's also difficult.
Quite honestly, life's all about how you define things. It's expectations. A very wise person told me life is about expectations. And I find that the older I get, the more that becomes true. And here, what are my expectations? Winning is how you define it. Winning, and I'm asking your listeners to walk with me here a little bit. Do I have to get into the governor and lieutenant governor's offices respectively? Travis and I have to get there to win. No, we don't. In fact, we can help change the culture and future of Ohio by getting as few as 3% of the vote. Well, how's that? Well, 3% does two things. 3% gets us that for the next 4 years, we'll have the opportunity to run candidates for everything from dog catcher to township trustee to sheriff to you name it, state house, you know. We can run anything we want and have the Libertarian Party on the ballot. Which, how do you increase the message and how do you increase the number of voters, the number of volunteers, the number of donors, if you're not allowed to have your name on the ballot? Which is, by the way, why the 3% law exists in the first place. Because
it's to crush the competition,
It's to crush the competition. If it was just about freedom of speech, there's an obvious answer, which is you get the petitions and your name says Libertarian on the petition, you can put it on the ballot. That's right. What First Amendment should be. That's not how it works. So 3% is a win fundamentally for that. But more importantly to your listener, because that's an inside thing. That's a Libertarian. It's a little selfish. And I think, you know, you can look at a big picture and make a justification. But the big thing for the average listener here, for the average voter, is 3% is probably going to be somewhere around the spread between these two old guys who are running against each other with their millions of dollars and lobbyists, okay? That's their spread. If you break their spread, then they can no longer ignore you. At the end of the day, presidential elections and statewide elections inside our country are fought in little 5% chunks. Both parties are going to count on 40-some percent of the vote coming their way unless they really do something crazy. And it's that final few percent, those swing voters, they call them. They're the ones that matter. But if a bunch of people say, you know what, I'm not just a swing voter who you're going to convince to buy one brand of dog food over another. No, I'm actually sick of all your dog food. I want something different. And if they see those voters leaving, guess who they're going to covet more than anything else? Those voters. They're going to have to change their tune. They're going to have to become more liberty-minded over as little as 3% of the vote. It can change everything. And the best example of this is
Gary Johnson. And I haven't looked at Gary's poll numbers in New Mexico lately, but he's running for Senate and he's got actually a shot. He's got a real shot. And what happens if you put in 50 Republicans, 49 Democrats, and one Libertarian in the Senate?
That changes everything.
It changes everything. But he's one guy. But he's the guy. Because whichever party wants something to happen needs that guy to do it. And it's the same thing if we can get 3 or 4 or 5% of the vote in Ohio. We become, as voters, that one guy. we force the old parties to say, I can no longer count on my base to get me over the hump. I can no longer convince a few extra points of worth of voters to get me over the hump. I need to be liberty enough. I need to be freedom enough. I need to be honest enough to get those 5%, because that's the block I need. And if nobody caters to it, then liberty will keep growing.
So do you think that, because from my perspective, you know, everyone's talking about a blue wave or a red wave, but I think that the Libertarian Party actually is kind of going to be a sleeper agent in this election, in the sense that a lot of people will get very far, if not win, in this election on, you know, more localized races, but races that still matter nonetheless. And there will be more LP candidates and party members in positions of power than really what we've ever had before. Do you think that is going to be kind of the ultimate takeaway from this election, and especially from your campaign, is the ability for people down ballot and then eventually, you know, to the position of governor, like what you all are running for? Do you think that ultimately is what this election cycle will walk away with?
I don't know. It depends on how you define it. I think, Caleb, what it ties to is I see where you're coming from here. I think the biggest thing is if you're allowed to be on the ballot and you get the ballot access, then it's not so much – and I guess where I'm kind of agreeing and kind of disagreeing. It's the fallout. It's not this race itself. It's the fallout that's really going to matter. It's next year in off-year elections where all of your local folks that you mentioned, that's where all your local folks are coming on the ballot. It's allowing them to come on and then speak to liberty and be a libertarian candidate on that local ballot and get 8% and get 12% and get 20% in a three-person race. Then you start to see if I'm – you know, if I'm in a small town in Wood County where I'm at, and I see there's a commissioner running and there's a judge running and there's a sheriff running and there's two township trustees running or something, and they're running as libertarians, and they collectively, maybe they're getting 5% or 8% or 10% or 12%. But now I'm hearing that message because I've got five or six people who are kind of in my sphere, in my local community, who are speaking to libertarian issues and who are trying to kind of change the way the debate goes. I mean, libertarians don't talk about, we don't talk about issues, different issues. We talk about the same issues differently. That's, you know, I fumbled through that, but that's really the key is the same issues matter to us. We just have a different perspective, and that perspective changes the entire debate that happens. And so the more libertarian candidates that are allowed to be on the ballot because of the ballot access that we're hoping to achieve this year, the next 2, 3, 4 years, that's where you start to build. And then when you run for governor in 4 more years, whoever our candidate may be is going to have a leg up and is going to have more local voter knowledge and is going to be aware, people are going to be aware of the party, and the message will be clear because people will start to hear it more. So it is a snowball effect, and the old parties know that as long as they can keep us off the ballot, then they can kill the snowball effect. We can't build momentum unless we're allowed to be on the ballot in the first place.
So let's shift a little bit more toward the issues now. And I want you to sort of speak one at a time. We'll kind of go at each side of the coin, if you will. For all of my listeners who are certainly from Ohio, for all those who are from here, I want you to speak to the ones who may be Republican inclined, and then I want you to speak to the ones who may be Democrat inclined, and tell me why your ticket is better all around for those who is more inclined to be GOP, and then why your ticket is better all around for those who are more inclined to be Democrat.
Okay.
So we'll start with the Republican. What separates you all positively from Mike DeWine?
Well, and the interesting thing, and I'll just say this up front as we to preface this whole issue section here, is that DeWine and Cordray are exceedingly similar in terms of where they're going to land on almost everything. And what I've said in the speeches that I've given is that Ohio will look no different 4 years from now, regardless of whether it's DeWine or Cordray that wins. Cordray is going to have to work through the state house. It's probably going to be Republican controlled. They're not going to give him anything. He's not going to give them anything. It's going to be kind of status quo. DeWine is big money, old money, lobbyist loyal. I don't know that he's going to really move the needle all that much. I mean, things are kind of going to be the same. So as far as the Republican voter, my appeal to them is I have a lot of Republican friends, a lot of whom are Republican donors and have been for years. And to a person, none of them like Mike DeWine. They just don't want Richard Cordray. It's just not it's the other guy. I don't want to vote for I'm not going to waste my vote on a Libertarian because I'm too afraid of Richard Cordray. Really? Really? I mean, guys, come on. If you don't want the Republicans to give you another junk old school, it's his or her turn candidate, then stop voting for it. It's that simple. Just don't do it anymore. Because as long as they can win with their recycled, old, tried dog, they're going to give you that recycled, old, tried dog every single time.
And they're encouraged by it because the voters reward it.
Yes. They got their donations. Their lobbyists are happy. The big corporate donors are happy. And they won the race. Why would they do anything different next time? And so you're going to say, well, I don't like that. I think it's ridiculous. I want a better candidate. I want a fresher face. I want somebody who really represents me. I'm just afraid of Cordray, so I'll just vote DeWine. Okay, it's exactly what you're going to get next time. And that's exactly what you're going to get for Senate, exactly what you're going to get for the presidency, because the party is going to pick the guy. The voters don't. The base doesn't. It's the party. And you saw what happened with Trump. He was the ultimate rebellion against that party, that old game. And he's the outlier, not the norm. And to expect that to keep happening, you're just going to get the old party guys to double down and push harder against a guy like Trump next time, be it at the state house level or at the White House level.
So you all have stated that, you know, your ticket is really the only ticket who is really viable at fighting the opioid crisis, which is really bad in Ohio. Tell me why that is. Obviously, you all support marijuana legalization and things like that. Why are those issues especially important to your campaign?
I have a lot of personal experience, and I think a lot of Ohioans can share that with friends and family members who have become addicted either through opioids, prescription opioids, or straight into the so supposedly, you know, class one narcotic hard drugs. And they've affected me and they've affected my life. They've affected my family. The one thing that I've seen consistently when I talk to people is I ask them this: would your loved one be better off in prison or in rehab? And nobody says prison. And if they do, it's because of some ancillary stuff that happened. Like, well, this person was evil. You know, they hit somebody, they're, you know, they assaulted somebody, whatever. They deserve to be in prison. But just for the drug aspect of it, everybody thinks their loved one should be in rehab. Then why are we sending them to prison? And then we back out. And I know a few prosecutors. I know lawyers in general. A lot of the law and order type friends I have in general, especially on the Republican side, they'll say, well, if we don't arrest them, if we don't have the threat of arrest, then, you know, we really don't put them in jail up front.
You know, we want to work with them and we want to put them through rehab, but we use jail as a threat, as last resort, right? We need that. We need that pressure to keep them honest. And see, but do you realize what happens to the father who gets arrested for possession? And, oh, you know, we just held him overnight and we did this other thing. Okay, then he was late for work the next day and got fired. Or that bail that he posted cut into his rent money and his family lost their apartment. Like, irreparable damage to a family or one person can happen on a 48-hour hold.
with a 1 week jail stint. So that employed person now becomes unemployed and the death spiral starts. And so it's like there is such a huge societal cost to having it be illegal. And I was even talking to a friend of mine the other day about what would happen if you could actually have a real live heroin addict go to a school assembly for, say, junior high kids, right, when they start becoming really susceptible to this problem. And they could sit down there and, like, literally shoot up. And my friend, like, their face just lit, like, oh, my gosh, they went white. Like, could you even imagine, like, how horrible? Why would you do that? And, like, why wouldn't I do that? If you want to show kids how awful it is, have an addict, because every addict I've ever talked to says they don't want to be an addict and they hate being an addict and they want to quit and they wish they could quit and they never wanted to start. I don't know any happy addicts. There aren't any. So you have one in there and they shoot up and it's just gross and they got the needles and they got their arm and they just pass out on the floor and they're basically like just they're zoned out because that's ultimately what happens. Like, you want to make it real for kids? Get the cops out of the room at the DARE program. Show them right. What it really does, right? Bring it home. But because it's illegal, you're not going to get anybody who can do that. You're not getting any discussion. Parents can still pretend, well, it's illegal, so my kids won't get it. Or they're running DARE program, and they'll just talk them out of it. It's like, you know, decriminalizing it is different than endorsing. Nobody hates drugs more than I do. But the only thing worse than drugs is putting people in prison or even threatening them with prison or even arresting them in the first place, because just simple arrests, court hearings, rehab dates, commitment times interfere with your job. They interfere with your school. They can mess up your life alone. Just those things that government minders are telling us, oh, they can be positive. They're life transforming. Yeah, they're transforming until you miss work. Then they're really transforming, but not in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a ton of ancillary costs to the whole thing.
This is a little bit off topic, but kind of on topic at the same time. I'm assuming that you in particular are in support of issue one here in Ohio.
I'm actually not.
Oh, really? Okay, go ahead and explain that for us then.
I love the mission of issue one. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, the fundamental premise is, hey, we want to make sentencing a lot lighter, basically only put people in prison who are high-level drug dealers, really trafficking, and you give a lot of slaps on the wrist for, you know, possession, minor use issues, right? So on the surface, and they'll also release people who have been incarcerated already on these minor technicality kind of, you know, had a little dime bag or something, you know, get them out of jail. The problem is twofold. One, and this is the big one, it's a high one and a small two. Number one and really big is it's amending our state constitution. The Buckeye Institute did a great review of this the other day that I read, and it basically said what I knew in my heart already, which is the constitution is for high level, big picture stuff, period. It's law and order. Protection of rights kind of stuff. When you get into sentencing and fines and allocation of resources, those are legislative actions and should be done through the normal legislative process. And trying to say, well, because our legislature is broken and won't do this, and pat on the back for me and Travis running for governor, the old two candidates are not going to fix this problem because it's too politically a hot potato. They'll do their polling data. They'll say it's too touch and go. Don't mess with it. It's a hot potato. So that's one. Make it legislative, not constitutional. The second part is they're writing into our constitution how to spend the supposed savings. And I believe there would be savings from releasing prisoners and not incarcerating as many people. But you're supposed to calculate that in 2016, 2017, 2018 dollars in tax savings. Then 50 years from now, when our Constitution still has this amendment proposed in issue one, we're still going to be calculating out these supposed savings and spending them in the proposed ratio that's illustrated in this amendment. That's insane. We cannot be binding ourselves to spending limits and constraints inside of our Constitution, because that's a forever thing. And again, that's why it should be legislative. So, you know, item two kind of ties back into item one.
So if this issue were to make its way through the legislature, then it would be something that you would be in support of, in theory anyway.
I love it wholeheartedly. It's great. It's a great step in the right direction. It's not the end game, but it's a great step in the right direction. And I think it would help thousands of Ohioans and their families find peace and employment and serenity and hopefully sobriety through that process. Because one thing I know from having incarcerated family is that it's easy to get drugs in prison. And so if we pretend like somehow sending people to prison helps their drug problems, I'd argue it actually makes it worse.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the reason I bring that up is because a lot of times whenever I hear opposition to it, it somehow always goes back to the fact that if this passes, then the hammer that is the threat of jail time would be removed away. And I always thought that was a very weak argument, because that's not making anyone's lives better. You're either forcing them to do something that might or might not work as quickly as you want it to, and then when it doesn't, then you're going to throw them in jail and ruin their lives anyway. And that never really made sense to me.
Well, and part of the problem, I have a friend who's going through some of this right now, and she is stuck with mandatory rehab as part of a jail, get out of jail free card, right? Like, okay, you got caught, you have some addiction issues, go to rehab. Well, she's got to meet up with her counselor from time to time. And it's like, well, what happens when that's 2 o'clock on a Wednesday and she's supposed to be at work?
Yeah.
So your mandatory, while well-intended, kind of this, the government thrives at the law of unintended consequences, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, well, we're helping little Susie over here because little Susie's got a drug problem, and we're going to make her go to rehab with the threat of jail if she doesn't show up. However, the mandatory rehab doesn't conform to her hours of employment, so we're really going to make her life hell because she's going to have to be late for job, give up vacation time, potentially lose her job because she needs to tell them where she's going or have a receipt or something, a note. I mean, you create all kinds of problems even when you're looking at this from like, well, yeah, we kept her out of jail and we really helped her out. Like, no, you didn't. And that's the problem with these top-down measures. They're not reflecting people's personal reality. And you know, one of the things I do know about addiction is you got to hit your own rock bottom. Nobody can make it for you. You've got to decide when you're ready. And unfortunately, we're trying to force people to be ready for something that many times they're just not. And that's why they fail so high. They're, you know, the rehab fails. So rehab failure rate is so high is because people just aren't ready. We're forcing them in.
So let's shift gears a little bit here. And let's talk about, education. Education is a big issue in Ohio that is, especially within the past few years, under the Kasich administration, it's become very popular. What is your sort of plan that separates yourselves from, Richard Cordray or Mike DeWine?
Well, I'm guessing that 4 years from now, if either of them win, the state will still have an unconstitutional funding mechanism for our school system. And it's been unconstitutional, and I should know this, but I think it was 1992 or 93 it was ruled by our state Supreme Court as unconstitutional. So for, you know, quarter century, we've been violating it, and we're going to keep violating it. And so Travis and I would change that and get us into compliance by truly making funding equitable. And how do you do that is you promote it, have the money, follow the kids. And the administrators and the school boards in the state, they scream foul at that. You know, all these charter schools are taking all of our money and they're getting really lousy scores. And yet parents are choosing to send their kids to these schools. So what you're saying is either the parents are insane or your arguments are false. And I don't think the parents are insane. If a parent is sending their child to a charter school, they're seeing value there, regardless of what the state testing is telling you. Because my wife is actually, she just retired young and may go back to it, but she's retired for now from being a teacher at an intervention specialist. So she taught in basically an intervention school. It was a charter school. And all they had were the kids that Toledo couldn't handle. And Toledo Public Schools, struggled getting these kids good grades. And guess what? Most of these kids are failing at the school my wife taught at. Is that the school's fault? Is that the program's fault? No, some kids are just going to struggle. And if the parents think they're getting better attention and they're progressing, I trust the parents far more than I trust a test or an administrator or a government official who's never met the kid. I will put the teachers and the parents on a very, very high plane of importance here, that the kid's getting what he or she needs. And I don't think we should be dictating to parents where their kids should be going to school. And when we have the money following the school instead of the money following the kid, then all we're going to get are failing schools that complain that they need more money so that they can stop failing. And that's just not how it works.
Mm-hmm. Right before we start to round off, there is one other issue I do want to cover. And that is on the issue of gun rights. Now, obviously this is one that is very, heated, and a lot of people get very worked up about it. But actually, I do believe that Ohio has been trending in the right direction as of late on the issue of gun rights. Certainly nowhere where we need to be, however. What are some areas that you would like to fix should you and Travis win in here in a couple weeks?
I don't think Ohio is all that bad. Ultimately, there really isn't a correlation between stricter drug laws or gun laws or higher gun sentencing versus actual, we'll call them shootings, just generic shootings, murders, collectively. There's no correlation. Chicago and D.C. have really bad crime rates involving guns, and they have some of the toughest laws regarding guns. Some of the loosest states, your high plains states, Texas, don't really have problems. And you'll say, oh, well, there was a mass shooting. Like, if somebody wants to kill people, that's such a bad example. You can fill a bus or a truck, a rental truck, full of things. As we saw at the Oklahoma City bombing back in the 90s, Jeff McVeigh, Timothy McVeigh, that's it, Timothy McVeigh. That guy blew up a building. He didn't use a gun. You want to blow up a plane, you don't use a gun. I mean, there are lots of ways that people who want to harm other people. Look at France. They drive cars or trucks through the sidewalk on a busy day, right?
Yeah. England has people throwing acid in people's faces.
And so they've got machete attacks. Okay?
Yeah.
There's a difference between a
culture problem and a legal problem. And it's the same. It's a great way to tie this all together, Caleb, as I try to wrap myself up because I get long-winded. But drugs, it's a culture problem, not a legal problem. Abortion, it's a culture problem, not a legal problem. It's like I'm pro-life, but you can't. If murder's illegal, rape is illegal, and yet people still murder and rape people. You can make guns illegal. You can make drugs illegal. You can make abortion illegal. You can do all kinds of stuff and say it's illegal. But ultimately, it comes down to winning over the hearts and minds of individual people and making our society more loving and caring and respectful toward each other and encouraging personal freedom and liberty, not expecting the government to solve our problems for us, but to get together as small communities, as civic groups, as churches and synagogues and mosques, to work together collectively to help each other out instead of looking to some elected official to do it for us. That's how you build responsibility. That's how you eliminate drug problems. That's how you eliminate gun problems and gun violence. It's not by banning things. Banning things is a knee-jerk, simple, and failed solution to any problem.
That brings up another point, actually, that I'm curious about your take on. Do you think, with how divided and how at each other's throats we are throughout the country, do you think that the greater chance of having more voices and more diversity of ideas, not just saying that, it's one team versus the other, do you think that will have sort of the positive yet not necessarily the first intended consequence of helping our national discourse?
I think things are going to have to get worse before they get better. And it's funny saying that because I think a lot of people think, well, this is as bad as the rhetoric's ever been. Like, I don't know, go way back. Things, you know, dudes had duels in the street and people got shot.
Right. Like, you know,
there's some famous stories from grade school. You remember back, right?
Yeah, 1800 is the election that I like to point to that, like, if it got that bad, then we're still fine as of right now.
The more divided the country feels, the more people are going to, I think, get sick of the old system and want something new, which is why more than ever, it's important that you have a third option. And frankly, if Travis and I weren't on the ballot, I'd tell you to vote for the Green Party. And if the Green Party wasn't and the Constitution Party was, I'd tell you to vote for them. And if it was the frickin' Communist Party, maybe not, but almost.
Right. Right.
You need to vote for anybody but the big two because we need competition. I don't think Europe does a lot right. But if you look at the European legislatures,
they do have competition in their electoral process.
Some of these groups, you go to like Holland, they've got like 8-9 different political parties involved in their system. So that everything needs a coalition and everything has to be brought about in a very holistic way to bring wide ideas and wide concepts instead of narrow old thinking to get solutions. And that's really cool. And while democracy is not written into our Constitution, and Democrats always shrug their, no, it's not possible. Well, read it. You haven't, I know, but read it. Democracy's not in there. But having a democratic discussion is something I think all of us can have appeal to us. And that's how you do it. You bring in more voices. I mean, really, if you look at the Republican Party, you've got a liberty wing for sure. You've got a fundamental Christian conservative wing. And you've got what I'll call the true moderate establishment wing. I mean, they're just there to get power no matter what. Democrats have the green wing. They've got the social justice wing. And they've got their moderate power at all costs party, segment of their party. There are really like 7 different political parties in D.C. right now. But they only run under 2 headings. And if you actually parse those subcategories out, you'd find a lot more, I think a lot better ability to kind of say, oh, that's why I don't necessarily want to vote for that person, or that's why I think that person's really got it. And they're having to build this coalition with these other groups. And isn't that interesting? And we'd be, I think, freer to speak our own honest minds instead of trying to hide and fit into 2 very large but rigid boxes.
Before we head out, there's a few, I guess, a lightning round of questions that I want to ask you. First of all, what is it that that inspired you the most to take up these ideas? You mentioned earlier on the program that you had your turning point into libertarianism, that or your coming home story into libertarianism. If you could name a book or a person that kind of sold it the most for you, what would you say that would be?
Neil Bortz, hands down. I was a traveling salesman, and Neil Bortz was syndicated in Dayton when I was driving around, and I listened to him. He had a radio show out of Atlanta, it was nationally syndicated, and he was an open libertarian. And it's like, it didn't take but a few days, like, wait, this guy's saying exactly what I think, and he's a libertarian, so maybe I'm a libertarian. And it was like, of course, I thought I was Republican, but I wasn't. I just didn't know. I didn't have a true understanding of what it was to be libertarian until he kind of opened my eyes to it. And it was nice because it was self-evident. He didn't convince me of anything at all. I was already convinced. I just didn't know what I was convinced of. He defined it for me.
Mm-hmm. If you had to give a quick pitch as to one or two lines as to why people should vote for you and Travis, what would that be?
Everyone complains, everyone I know that is, complains about being sick and tired of the grumblings and the arguments and the polarization and the complaining and the bickering and the money and the special interest groups and the lobbyists. And then they vote for the people that support all of that. Just stop. Do yourself a favor. try something different. It won't hurt, I promise. Pull the lever for us. You'll feel great the next day knowing you did the right thing instead of the thing you thought you had to do to avoid somebody even worse than the guy you thought you had to vote for.
And finally, where can people find out about your campaign? Where can people find you and Travis on social media? And how can they help in these final days leading up to the election?
Yeah, the internet's a great thing. Irvine for Ohio, it works online. It works on Facebook, works on Twitter. So find all our stuff there. Irvine for Ohio. It's easy.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Todd. I appreciate this. I'm happy to have had you on. And best of luck to your efforts. Hopefully we can get some good out of your campaign.
I really enjoyed it, Caleb. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. And for everyone listening, please be sure to follow me at Caleb Franz on Twitter. Be sure to follow the show at MidLiberty on Twitter. Follow the MidLiberty Initiative on Twitter at MidLiberty.org. Be sure to check us out on Facebook at the MidLiberty Initiative and subscribe to us on iTunes so that you'll never miss an episode or an update. And until next week, we'll see you.